Tonight on Arena, John Connolly talks to us about his new novel, The Nameless Ones, and Aoife McArdle on her new short film starring Cillian Murphy. +51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. Well, after the extreme sporting exertions of last weekend, and indeed the month of entertainment that was the 2020 Euros, you'd be forgiven if you were experiencing withdrawal symptoms this week. But worry not, the Olympics kick off next week, and to mark this, our man in RTE Sport, Damien O'Mara, has been taking a look at artistic representations of the Olympics on film. The Olympics, which is, of course, a global event, lending itself to all kinds of drama. Damien with me in studio before he heads out for Tokyo next week. Lucky man to be going there. And I guess as a sports person, Damien, you're going to tell me the biggest problem with films about sport is the sport.
Yeah. Now, before people go, oh, I don't like sport, I'm going to switch off. You know, I appreciate there are people that can't abide sport. And I often try to remind people that at its core, there's great stories which happen to be about sports people or happen to be about sports events, but it's a great story at its core. But whether it is or it isn't, these things fall apart very quickly if the representation of the sport itself, they make a hames of it, which too many people have tended to do time and time again. So the situation is, I think if you have a diehard sports fan who looks at something and goes, that's not how sport is played at all, it loses credibility straight away. But I think a lot of the films that we're going to talk about have made a really good job at it, or have focused on the story itself rather than the live action, which can be perilous.
Yeah, and as you say, even if you're not a big sports fan, if the live action isn't up to scratch, you kind of, you know there's something not quite right about it, and it can ruin the film on you.
Yeah, oh, completely. And you look, and it has happened time and time again, that really bad stories have great recreations of sporting action, or really bad creations of sporting interaction, you lose track of the story at the core of it, because it loses credibility. So we're going to try and avoid a lot of that.
Of course, because the reality of particularly the Olympics, you know, it takes a long time to get yourself, if you're a sports person, into the position that you can even be thinking about the Olympics. So there's a big human drama well ahead of the drama that's going to take place on the sporting field.
Massively so. And I think one of the areas that you need to be careful of when you're speaking about these are that you have people that have dedicated their life's work for what could be a couple of minutes in the spotlight. And straight away, we will look at Sean Rocks as being a failure because he's failed to advance beyond this heat here or that heat there, or Damien O'Mara is a hero because he's done this. And the reality of it is you're dealing with people that have dedicated their lives, be it to training, be it to dedication to a sport, to get to what is the like minute percentage of people who compete on these levels. And then you go back through history and you go back through so many incidents where there are these phenomenal human beings who have overcome massive challenges in life, be it, you know, physical challenges, issues of persecution, issues of God knows what it is, to overcome it all and eventually compete on the world's top level. They are remarkable human beings.
And I don't know if you'd have this statistic to hand, but I'm sure the difference between the winning time in the 100 metre sprint, just to take that, and the slowest heat of the 100 metre sprint, you know, whoever that was, and all of those heats, it's probably not that big a margin.
It is that.
Yeah. A split second probably. Yeah. You know, so anyway, and we're going to talk about track and field to start out with, and Chariots of Fire. This kind of is the mammy and the daddy of all the Olympic films, isn't it?
I think if we were to go family fortunes and ask 100 people to name a film related to the Olympics, Chariots of Fire is probably the one that's going to come out on top. And it's bizarre. It's one of those films that I think so many people have watched that you probably couldn't tell somebody what Olympics it's about or what the you know, it's a story of two individuals. And I suppose, will we get it out of the way? Iconic theme tune.
Let's listen. I'm expecting now, Damien, I wish we had cameras, because I was looking forward to some lovely slow motion running from you.
Yeah, who hasn't pretended to run in slow motion to this? Have you done it?
Oh, I couldn't hear that. The music was in my ear.
We'll be right back.
And you know, Baywatch can get lost. The entire field running as they do, even as they're kind of during their training periods running in slow motion to that Vangelis music. It's brilliant
and
to watch.
Unsurprisingly, one of the four Oscars it won back in it was released in 1981. The best original score amongst the four Oscars that it won. Like, this is the iconic Olympics film. It's built around the 1924 Games. The story of Eric Liddell, Harold Abrahams, and two like really significantly different characters, and two men that had very different reasons to try and achieve success, and for very different reasons. Liddell, a devout Christian, running to honour the glory of God, and Abrahams, who was a Jew, and experiences, and it's actually really graphically shown in the film as well, first-hand experiences of persecution of upon entering the University of Cambridge. There's a whole load of side stories in this, that it's not just the story of two men that want to achieve success at the Games. It's the baggage and the issues that they bring with it, and what running and what their backgrounds represent to them, and you know, the issue as well of one man deciding not to partake in the 100 metres, which was his number one event, because the heats were staged on a Sunday, and that's something that sports people have battled with over the years. This was a massive commercial success, except in France. So it was built around the 24 Games, and the French really hated the way that they were portrayed in it, and the references that were made to French culture and how they staged the games. The US release had to be edited because there was loads of references to cricket at the start, and the US audience in the early 80s didn't have an iota what cricket was all about. So I think this is probably the iconic film of all iconic films.
Let's have a listen to a clip which features Ian Charlton as Eric Liddell, who's the Christian end of the pair that are involved in the running. He's in voiceover here as he trains. He's talking about his faith.
It says in the old book, "He that honours me, I will honour." Good luck, Jackson Schultz.
Up above. Nice.
So where does the power come from to see the race to its end? From within. Jenny, I believe God made me for a purpose. But he also made me fast. And when I run, I feel his pleasure.
Music beginning to creep in underneath it there. In Charleston as Eric Liddell in Chariots of Fire, and talking about his faith and how God basically sent him out to run. But you were saying, Damien, as we were listening to that, Damien O'Mara speaking to me about great films about the Olympics this evening, you were saying as we were listening to that, that in fact there's huge artistic license around the story that's told here.
So he had decided months in advance of the Games that he wasn't going to compete in the 100 metres because it would have meant running on a Sunday. And I think when you watch the film back, it's seen as this inner struggle in the run up to the Games and very close to the Games, and while they're travelling across, and I think the Prince of Wales is brought in as a side character to try and influence him to run, when in reality the decision was made and he knew well in advance that he wasn't going to compete in what was his marquee event, and instead he focused on other events along the way. And then Abrahams obviously took the gold medal. So the story of these two men, it wasn't this great struggle between the two of them as to who was going to win the gold in that event. It had all been put to bed. The other thing that with the week that's in it, the Open Championship taking place in golf this week, that the very iconic scene of them running along the beach was filmed along parallel to the 18th hole in St Andrews.
Now
it's pretending to be somewhere else, but in reality it's the 18th hole in St Andrews.
There was never a location that was very seldom the location is the location.
The next time you watch it,
if you think of that. Alright, I suppose this is kind of at a tangent to the Olympics, the second film that you have for us, Spielberg's 2005 film Munich.
Yeah, far from light viewing, but I think critically a very well received film, albeit one which did ridiculously bad business for Spielberg in the States. I don't know if this is testament to its objectivity, but it's a film that annoyed, or certainly offended all quarters, the pro-Israeli camp, the pro-Palestinian camp. I think a lot of people, again, the Olympics is almost the backdrop in all of this. The 1972 Games marred by the murder of 11 members of the Israeli team by members of the Black September movement. Mossad then deployed a five-man team to avenge that massacre through the murder of 11 Palestinians. Critically acclaimed, really controversial. Spielberg subsequently did interviews. He did virtually, I don't think he did a single pre-release interview. He spoke to Roger Ebert, the iconic film reviewer at the Chicago Times, I think, the week post-release, to basically say, I have lost friends over this. I have offended people from every side.
There were all sorts of arguments about impartiality.
Exactly. Yeah. And again, you know, Spielberg, his grandparents were Ukrainian Jews who relocated to the States. He subsequently spoke, and I don't think he's hidden away from the fact that he's very much in favour of the state of Israel. Everybody was unhappy with this in terms of the political aspects of it. And he was accused of integrating aspects of history into the film which had no place there. He was accused of ignoring aspects of history which should have been part of the story making. But I think, critically, a very hard watch, but a very strong film.
A very opposite end of the spectrum is the next film that you have for us from 1993. If even the thought of this movie, I think, would be enough to make most people smile. Cool Runnings.
Yeah, this was a deal breaker for me, Sean. If we didn't mention Cool Runnings, I was going to forever boycott the program and everyone associated with it. Feel the rhythm, feel the rhyme. Come on up. It's bobsled time. So. You've touched on it. This is a film. I don't think you can watch this and not feel better about life. The story of the Jamaican bobsleigh team qualified for the 1988 Winter Games in Calgary, became the centre of attention, obviously representing a nation which is known for its tropical climate and its success in sprinting in the Summer Games. The background, and this is only very briefly touched upon in the film, the Jamaican Olympic Committee were urged by an American diplomat to embrace the fact that they had these phenomenally talented natural athletes. And if you can do it in the summer sports, you can appropriate some of their skills for the winter sports. So obviously they had brilliant sprinters. They had a massively successful kind of bobsleigh pushcart heritage of, you know, self-made go-karts, and marry the two. And so here you go.
Yeah, let's have a listen to a clip. Dougie Doug as Sanka here and Leon Robinson. And they're talking about, you know, bobsleigh, Jamaica. Let's have a listen.
You know, when the Swiss won again.
Shut up about the damn Swiss. I mean, it was all that Heinz Vine dry nonsense that got us all nervous in the first place.
Hey, man, look here. I'm just trying to get this off on the right foot.
Well, the right foot for us is not the Swiss foot. I mean, come on, dearies. We can't be copying nobody else's style. We have our own style.
Kissing an egg is no kind of style. It's the Olympics here. This is no stupid pushcart derby.
Let me tell you something, Rasta. I didn't come up here to forget who I am and where I come from.
And neither did I. I'm just trying to be the best I can be.
So am I. And the best I can be is Jamaican. Darius, I've known you since Julie Jeffries asked to see you ding-a-ling. And I'm telling you as a friend, if we look Jamaican, walk Jamaican, talk Jamaican, and is Jamaican, then we sure as hell better bobsled Jamaican.
Oh yeah, national pride is everything. That's a clip from Cool Runnings, the Jamaican bobsleigh team, and it's essentially a comedy film around that. Damien, again, you were talking about, I was asking you, first of all, as we were listening there, you know, they have to start out as being totally hopeless as a team, and yet progress enough that you can kind of believe that they'd even be there.
And then I think if you watch it and if you took it at face value, you would think, oh, geez, the poor creators, they were robbed of a medal because they had a crash very late on in their run. And then you have this iconic image of them in the film carrying the bobsled over the line. Some of that happened. Like, that isn't a million miles away from history. But the fact is, they were never near a medal. And I don't think they ever expected to be near a medal. They had a really bad crash, and I think it was the third of their four runs. Whereas in the film, you're almost led to believe that they're on the verge of claiming the medal. And, you know, they pushed their bobsleigh over the line in reality. They did actually become a massive story at the time, but in part because I think it was the American ice hockey team had been knocked out really early. And the big American networks, who spend a fortune on the Olympics, needed needed something to fill coverage with, and all of a sudden it's let's latch on to
story.
The Jamaicans have sent a team to the bobsled. So I think, you know, it's one of those brilliant films. It's one of those really feel good films, and I think John Candy in particular is one of the great comedic performances, which I think plays a large role in why it lives on so long.
I, Tonya, 2017, we're in the world of ice skating here. This is a film as much about the lead up to the Olympics as it is about the Olympics themselves.
Yeah, it's one of those situations where if you're into ice skating at all, and I think it's one of those stories that's transcended it at this stage. Tonya Harding, Nancy Kerrigan, the two golden girls of American figure skating, ice skating, massive rivalry. People will be aware, or a lot of people will be aware, that there was a really vicious attack on Nancy Kerrigan. It subsequently emerged that, now, Tonya Harding has always disputed that she had any knowledge of it, but was her husband and people close to her were responsible for the attack on Kerrigan, which was aimed at ruling her out of the 1994 Games. This is a black comedy. It breaks the fourth wall. It focuses predominantly on Tonya Harding and her mother. So it's Margot Robbie and Alison Janney. It's brilliant.
That mother-daughter relationship, I have a clip here that gives you a sense of, you know, we've heard of Fesh mothers, we've heard of GAA mothers. Well, a ice skating mother is a whole different ballgame if you go by this clip. Alison Janney as the mother, won an Oscar for this, in fact. Tonya Harding's awful mother, Lavona, and Margot Robbie as Tonya, asks her mother a heartfelt question, and Mum is rather foul-mouthed, it must be said, in her response.
When I was a kid, did you ever love me or anything?
You think Sonia Henny's mother loved her? Poor fucking you. I didn't stay home making apple brown Bettys. No, I made you a champion. Knowing you'd hate me for it. That's the sacrifice a mother makes. I wish I'd had a mother like me instead of nice. Nice gets you shit. I didn't like my mother either, so what? I fucking gave you a gift.
You cursed me. You're a monster.
Spilled milk, baby.
Oh, if you want to know where Tonya Harding got her hard edge, then perhaps the mother gave her a bit of it there. Alison Janney and Margot Robbie in that scene from I, Tonya.
I just want to give, you know, credible mention to Margot Robbie, because we talked at the outset about recreating sporting moments. She did massive training in order to be able to do the more basic of the... Now, when it gets into the massively intricate routines, they are body doubles, but she apparently got to a ridiculously high level of skating ability in order to be able to do the more basic of routines. So credit where credit is due.
Documentary that you want to mention?
Yeah, I wanted to mention the Paralympics, obviously upcoming as well, and there's always massive interest from an Irish perspective. It's an area that we've achieved so much in recent years. There's a Netflix documentary called Rising Phoenix, which focuses on a number of Paralympians, particularly around the time of the London Games. A phenomenal insight into, you know, the effort that is taken to compete at the highest level. So that's non-fiction, but certainly one that's worth viewing.
And finally, Unbroken from 2014.
Again, a story which happens to be about an Olympian rather than a story about the Olympics, directed by Angelina Jolie. The story of Louis Zamperini, a veteran of World War II. He competed at the 1936 Games in Berlin, shot down, survived 50 days in a raft after getting shot down, subsequently captured by the Japanese, sent to multiple prisoner of war camps. It is a phenomenal story of human endeavour by a man who happened to compete at the Olympics, but a brilliant story.
You're heading off. When are you heading off to the Olympics?
I go on Monday.
Monday.
So it is going to be the most unique experience. I've luckily privileged to be in London, privileged to be in Rio. This is going to be the COVID Olympics, restrictions the like of which none of us ever thought we would have to live through. But I think it's going to be unlike anything that any of us will ever experience again.
All right. Well, no doubt we'll be hearing from you during your time there. Best of luck with it all. That's Damien O'Mara sharing some of his favourite Olympic films with us this evening. A blend of Private Eye, horror and speculative fiction. The Charlie Parker novels are unique in the annals of crime fiction. The Nameless Ones is the 20th novel from John Connolly to feature Charlie Parker, and John is with me in studio this evening. And I would say it features Charlie Parker, and it certainly does, John, but you gave us the origin story in The Dirty South. It's about a year ago now at this stage since we got that. But Charlie, he's just getting a little walk-on part in this one. Do you need to put him out to...
to pasture for every so often.
Some books are better suited to him than others, I think. I have a weakness for globe-trotting international thrillers, the kind that you read getting on and off planes. And I had begun this long before lockdown and COVID. And when it happened, it suddenly seemed like a piece of science fiction that you could have people jumping on and off aeroplanes without a care in the world. And yet I thought, you know, actually, in a time when nobody can go anywhere, there is something pleasantly escapist about that. And I think one of the things that awful period that we're coming out of, I hope, taught us all is the value of escapism, the value of something that takes you out of the world that you're living in, whether it was the rush of nostalgia people had for Friends or shows that they remembered from a time when everything seemed much more innocent, or the pleasure of picking up a book that simply takes you out of your world. And there's, you know, I sometimes think we're very hard on escapism, and yet there's a real pleasure in picking up a book that has no purpose other than to entertain you, really.
Well, now, you do more than entertain us here. You frightened me, certainly, once or twice.
You're a tender and delicate flower. Everybody says that, you know.
Yeah. Well, we'll come back to whether I'm tender and delicate in a minute. Let me clarify then. Did you have to, because I thought, poor John, he couldn't go anywhere. And he was writing all of this during lockdown, and he couldn't do any of this research in Vienna. He couldn't do any of this research in Paris, in London, in all of the cities of Europe, effectively. Did you actually get to do a bit of travelling around?
Yeah, it was the research had been done prior to all of this awfulness happening. So I was fascinated. I'd been asked to give a talk in Vienna. And that's a hop to Serbia. And I thought, my God, you know, this is the perfect opportunity to do this little bit of research. And it's quite a strange country. It's not a country that has a lot of Western tourism. It's not somewhere that suddenly strikes people, we go to Serbia. Because it has a kind of strange reputation, and one that's not entirely unjustified. You know, you arrive from the airport and there are Serbian flags lining the motorway. You go for a walk in the park and there are stalls selling Vladimir Putin football shirts in Serbian colours. It will be really interesting as it moves towards EU accession to see what happens with this country. Because the driver that I had, he came up with the best summary of the Balkan conflict, which he said, a lot of bad things happened and we were responsible for most of them, which seemed to me a very, very apt summary. But it's quite strange when you go, there isn't, one of the things I do when I go to a country like that is, you try to go to museums, you try to go to places where you might get a sense of how they view their own history. And there isn't really a historical museum in Belgrade, there is a military museum. And the military museum covers really every atrocity visited on the Serbs up to the end of the Second World War. And then Tito dies. And there is nothing from the death of Tito until they begin sending people on UN peacekeeping missions in the early part of this century. There is no mention of the Balkan conflict.
Wow.
It simply has
doesn't
been
doesn't exist.
Out. It doesn't. And yet, at some point, everybody will raise it very tentatively with you. But after, not immediately, and certainly they're quite uncomfortable with it. But there's a lingering sense of injustice.
Was this, again, this was something that I wondered, whether the Balkan conflict had been something that you had, that was scratching away at the back of your head for a long time as a potential starting point or a potential, you know, core area of the novel, or were you writing this and the Balkan conflict presented itself?
No, the two were together. One of the things mystery fiction is always interested in is the impact of the past upon the present, the sins of the fathers being visited on the sons. It's that part, yeah, the Faulkner quote, you know, the past is never dead, it's not even past. And I think what happened I don't think any of us, I would have been in my early 20s when this conflict began. I don't think any of us ever thought we would see that kind of warfare in Europe again. That kind of tearing apart of a society, the idea of ethnic cleansing, people behind barbed wire in concentration camps. You know, we did not think that would ever happen again. And suddenly it had manifested itself because, like I said, there were these lingering grievances, not just going back to the Second World War or the First World War, but even further back than that. And I think the Serbians made a very deliberate decision when they put people behind barbed wire in camps. They were sending a message, and what they were saying was, during the Second World War, the Croatian sided with the Nazis. Our people were put in concentration camps. And the Croatian Ustashi, it's one of those terrible things where you say what you like about the Nazis, which always sounds like a terrible way to begin a sentence. But, you know, what they did was the Nazis industrialized human destruction. They wanted it done as quickly and efficiently as possible. The Ustashi didn't want to do that. The Ustashi traded on cruelty.
Yeah.
And all of these memories remained. And what Tito had done was to say to all of these different ethnic groups, I don't care what your problems are with each other. You know, if you have a problem, you'll now have it with me. And so he tamped them down. And when he died, all of these fractures reappeared. And I found that fascinating because I got to tie into something that recurs again and again in crime fiction, that fascination with past sins.
Well, now, getting back to you, your accusation of my being a delicate flower.
I'm just saying what people say. You know, it's not an accusation.
I defy anybody to read any section of the book that has the name Radovan or Spiridon Vuksan in it. If you read a chapter where these two brothers are present, you will not, your blood will curdle at what they, particularly Spiridon, what he is capable of.
Yeah, one of the difficult things to do in a book is, and I don't know whether I succeeded, was that you kind of, there's a little part of you that's almost rooting for the bad guys. What they're like rats caught in a trap. They want to get back to Serbia. That route has been cut off for them. So they're stuck in Vienna trying to negotiate through their lawyer a way that they might be able to get home and realizing their enemies are drawing closer. And they try to find every way out of the trap. Any way they can, they try to take. And there's almost a sense of this animal desperation to them, which I wanted. And this lawyer who realizes that his fate is tied up with them. And then also, I didn't want to, one of the things I wanted to avoid was having something that I've learned that is best avoided, is to have long sections where people reflect in italics about the war. You know, the minute I think a reader of fiction sees italics, they think, here is something inessential. Here is something that I don't need to read. And so you're very gently putting in information and you're trying not to linger on atrocities. Often these things are referred to in glancing or there is a scene where a man watches blood dripping through floorboards and he realises that actually what's happening up there is so terrible that the ceiling can't take the blood. And that was taken from an incident that I remembered about Klaus Barbie in Lyon when the Gestapo set up their headquarters in Lyon. At one point, the roof, the ceilings bled. They couldn't take the amount of blood that was being shed. So you can do... when I was younger, I thought I had to beat people over the head with violence and say, look at this, look at this dreadfulness. Now I realise you can do much more by just having a man trying to move his chair so that blood doesn't fall on his head from the room up above.
Yeah, and that it's the vile spirit that I mentioned that's involved in that scene. And what you do, which I think makes it manageable for the reader, is that you give that in, I suppose, maybe 10 or 12 chapters, but all the time interspersed with something that gives you a chance as a reader to take a breath and say, all right, I'm glad I'm out of that room for a while. And then, oh no, here I go. I'm going back into it again.
There has to be humour and there has to, as you say, this is not about inflicting suffering on the reader. That word I used earlier, escapism and entertainment, I'm very conscious of those things. And yet it's a weird thing that we are entertained by. We like murders. We like thrillers. People are wrapped up. I know my own kids are wrapped up with the two Sophie Toscan Duplantier documentaries. We have this fascination. And it's not simply that we take a step and we look at it objectively and think, I'm looking at this through the prism of law and justice. We do it because we get a frisson from it. And so it is an odd thing for readers. When I get the finger pointed at me sometimes as a writer who produces occasionally violent thrillers, I do point out that I don't go around to people's houses, sit on their chests, read it aloud to them and then demand 20 quid in return. People make a conscious decision that they actually want to read this.
Yeah, okay. And I will admit that even though I found the scenes difficult, I kind of couldn't wait to get back into the room either at another level, which it plays into exactly what you're saying.
Well, maybe there's hope for you,
there's something in us that wants to see that. But I guess that this is your way, those two brothers, this is your way of actually saying, this is how we reflect on the war. Because these two brothers, Radovan and Spiridon, Radovan is kind of, he's the clean one, if you like. He's the Teflon brother. Nothing sticks there. And yet he orchestrated during the war, certainly he orchestrated an awful lot of things. Spiridon did the dirty work, but Radovan did the kind of orchestration behind it. But these two brothers, they're reflecting on the war by what they're doing today because they're looking for a kind of revenge. Or are they looking for something perhaps a little bit more noble than revenge?
I think they are. What we sometimes forget about Serbia is that it was a great imperial power for much of its history, and when the Archduke Ferdinand was killed at the beginning of the before the outbreak of the First World War, it provided an excuse for the Austro-Hungarians and the Prussians essentially to stamp on Serbia and to curb all of that. And yet there is this lingering memory when you go around this country, you see these extraordinary fortresses that the Serbians built. And they have this memory of fighting against the Turks, of being occupied in this very brutal occupation, and then again fighting against the Germans. And there, you know, it was a country that I didn't know a great deal about until I went there. And I went in conditioned, I think, by an awful lot of what I had seen in my 20s and what I had read. And the dreadful and undeniably dreadful things that the Serbians did during the Balkan War. And yet when you go there, you recognise that this is a cycle, that similar atrocities and worse were inflicted upon them for a very great deal of time. And you wonder what scars that leaves on the psyche of a country. And it will be this EU accession will be very interesting for Serbia, because Serbia, as far as I'm aware, is still regarded as a captured economy, which means that it is corrupt from the top down. And you don't have to be very long in Serbia before somebody tells you that. Mm. You know, why are we trying to be honest when everybody who rules us is patently dishonest? Mm. And a lot of this, a lot of these scars haven't healed. A lot of these fractures remain. We're in for a very interesting period, I think, when the Serbians enter. Because I think what we hope is that by entering the EU, we will be in a position, if should something happen again, to at least intervene in a more effective way than we did at the end of the 1980s.
Yeah, because you do visit Srebrenica and the UN Security Council Resolution 819 and what happened in that city, and you specifically mention Ratko Mladic and those involved.
Yeah, and all of these things that we remember, we've just been watching, you know, these trials again. This has gone on for decades. And I think what was terrifying about it was that we were simply unable or unwilling to do anything about it. It was a little bit of both. You know, it does mention that the Dutch battalion who had to abandon Srebrenica were under orders to do it. You know, had they stayed, they would probably have been massacred. Mm. You know, they would have probably died alongside everybody else. Their supply lines had been cut off. They were under bombardment. And yet, you know, I know from reading about the Dutch soldiers who left, they have this lingering sense of guilt about it, that some of them feel they should have stayed.
You give us a character who says precisely that.
Yeah,
you know,
we should have. That was what we were supposed to do.
I should have died nobly.
I should have stayed with them rather than living with this guilt. And maybe that guilt is shared across Europe and across NATO.
The other thing that struck me about the two brothers is this idea which you can extrapolate out of the Bosnian conflict into many conflicts, and indeed you could even extrapolate it out into Northern Ireland and the like, where you have these fighters involved in a war, and then subsequent to that war, these fighters are now basically
community workers.
Yeah, well, or criminals.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
Who, and you wonder to what extent was the involvement in the war just a cover for being a criminal from the outset, or did the war create the criminal?
Yeah, I think it's treading very carefully. I think that these situations sometimes provide flags of convenience for individuals who would have found ways to shed blood anyway. And when the conflict ends, they redirect their energies. But those energies never go away. There are very few. Most men of peace don't want to be drawn into a conflict, and certainly don't want to kill other people. And those who continually do it and do it without really any sense of remorse, they are problematical for society going on. I think would be the most diplomatic way of putting
it's
it.
Very nicely answered. And it is kind of where Radovan and Spiridon are on, in that it's easy to just dismiss them as Serbs, gone. I don't want to hear anything they have to say. But you have to look at why they are doing and how they got to be where they are.
Yeah, to understand doesn't excuse.
Yeah,
but
exactly.
But it does ensure that we may be able to deal with these things going down the line.
Now, we've only spoken about the Serbian, because there's a whole other side. We mentioned that Charlie has a little walk-on part, but Louis and Angel, his sidekicks, are much busier in this novel than usually. Well, they have been busy in previous novels too, but they're particularly busy here, aren't they?
They are. It was a chance to look at two characters who, when I began writing, were essentially just kind of comic relief. They were a way of showing a lighter side of Parker, and have become more interesting to me as a writer as I've gone on, because there is a sense of a dawning morality to them.
And yet in this book, they're simply hell-bent on revenge. And there is, you know, we were talking about just how awful these characters they're hunting are. There is a pleasure in seeing characters like that get their comeuppance. Mm. And to know that, they, you know, no matter how awful the things they do down the line, somebody is going to come. And though these are wish fulfillment things, we would love to think that in the event of our neighbour not returning the lawnmower, we could call two guys who will go around to him and advise him for his own good. Well, you know, it's very hard to mow your lawn with broken fingers, you know, so maybe you might want to give back the lawnmower. We love that idea that there might be somebody in what we perceive as a society, an existence, a life that doesn't always reward the good, that there might be the possibility that we could look for somebody from outside who would act on our behalf.
Yeah, and the other side of that is that then you kind of find yourself, when you take that a bit further down the line, so you're saying, okay, look, whatever happens to those two baddies, it doesn't really matter. And if you step outside the law to get to those two baddies, and if you behave in a way that is abhorrent and appalling, the end justifies the means. Is that part of the argument that you're having here as well?
Well, there is a fascination with that, and yes, we would like to think we could get away with that. But I think even Angel and Louis don't believe that. They don't believe that the end justifies the means, and they recognise that Parker, in particular, in the books, recognises that by acting in that way, you may imperil your soul. That this is not appropriate. And yet, just as there is a satisfaction for the reader in reading about these things, Parker recognised that there occasionally, if you're a man of rage, if you're a man filled with grief, the idea that you can lash out is very, very appealing. And the books toy with that. The books are interested in that tension between, a good man who essentially wants to be good, but has within him the capacity to do really, really terrible things. And to justify them to himself. Yeah, and that's the awful thing about people. We can justify almost anything to ourselves. Very few people set out to do evil. That's not really in the nature of most people. That's sociopaths and psychopaths. And they're very, very rare. What's frightening is that most of us can justify to ourselves doing terrible things because we feel that actually right is on our side. We had no other option.
Yeah, it kept springing to my mind as I was reading the book of an old Spanish Golden Age play, Lope de Vega, Justice Without Revenge. And, you know, is justice without revenge possible? In his case, it's a son who runs off with a young bride who was to be his bride. So it's a different area that we're in. But this idea that somehow justice can be meted out without revenge being involved in the case of these guys, because they're looking back. The Vuxcan brothers are looking back at a friend of theirs, let's just put it that way, who was murdered, and they want to get some revenge for that. Do you think that justice without revenge is a possibility?
But we're back almost to where we started with this whole nation that feels an act of injustice was perpetrated against it. Mm. And therefore it was entitled to revenge. Not just that revenge was a possibility, but that there was an entitlement to visit something of this back on other people. And that's where we get, that was the origins of the Balkan conflict. So, you know, I wish I was smart enough to answer some of these questions, you know, as you sit there grinning at me, thinking, thought he was just going to come on and sell his book to the populace, you know, I'll make him work for it.
No, but what, to be fair, so that you can sell the book to the populace, what you're doing in the book is you are having all of those debates, but they don't, you're not banging us over the head with a mallet with those debates.
It's the great thing about genre fiction is that genre fiction can sneak so much stuff in under the wire, and people don't feel that they're being preached at, and people don't feel that they're being hammered over the head, as you say. I'd read some fascinating, when I was researching the book, I'd read some really interesting pieces of fiction coming out of the Balkans about the conflict from people who had, mostly by women who had lived through it. And they're incredibly difficult to read.
Yeah,
and
I think specifically, didn't you read,
Hotel Tito is an extraordinary book.
And As If I Am Not There, which was subsequently made into a film by Juanita Wilson. Yeah. I mean, that's an extraordinary story.
And so you feel when you write, I don't want to say guilt exactly, but there is certainly a difficulty, to go back to that issue of entertainment, in using the backdrop to that conflict in a crime novel, and using any of these conflicts when you set them alongside a book like Hotel Tito, which is written by somebody who has lived through it and sees no entertainment value in it at all. But that's a very different book, and its purpose is very different.
You also, and because as I was reading this, I thought, there'll be no supernatural in here, but you bring it in, and again, I was kind of surprised fans of the long-term series will know when we mention Jennifer as Charlie's daughter. I don't think it's a spoiler to say that she's dead, you know, she's dead from the very outset of the series. You manage to get the supernatural in, but even in that supernatural world, there's a kind of a fight between good and evil going on, it would seem.
The supernatural part came in quite naturally, actually. There is a population, an ethnic population in Serbia called the Vlach, and the Vlach are regarded as the last great mainstays of witchcraft in Europe. You know, this is the Carpathian, the Carpathia, the Serbian side of the Carpathian, so just on the Danube, the Nubian border. And I thought it would be really interesting to go and have the Vlach in my book. It's quite difficult to go and find witches these days, because they don't, you know, I thought I was, you kind of have a vision almost like of a Halloween village or the start of Dracula, Prince of Darkness, where, you know, there are going to be people wandering around in big hats with warts. And that really wasn't the case. It was actually immensely difficult initially to find Vlach witches. But I was fortunate enough, by asking enough questions and having some cooperative people, I was fortunate enough to be introduced to some of the Vlach. And they have very interesting ancestor worship, a curious mix of Christianity and other beliefs. And so it naturally seemed to feed into the book.
Well, it did that. Great to talk to you, as always, John.
Thank you very much.
A great set of ideas that you get around while entertaining us and frightening us, even if we are delicate little flowers.
There's nothing wrong with you that a spell in the army won't cure.
John Connolly speaking to us about his latest novel, The Nameless Ones, which is published by Hodder & Stoughton. In All of This Unreal Time, a short film that featured at the Manchester International Film Festival, Cillian Murphy plays a man on an existential mission walking through the empty lockdown streets of an anonymous city at night. His nameless character reflects on shame, guilt and masculinity and berates himself for not having treated other people and the planet with more care. With a text by Max Porter, a score by John Hopkins, alongside the music of Aaron and Bryce Dresner of the National, the film is directed by Aoife McArdle, who I'm delighted to say joins us this evening. You couldn't have got a better group of people together, particularly Max Porter and Cillian Murphy, who have a track record together in terms of Grief is a Thing with Feathers and the stage realisation of that particular piece, Aoife. Was it in and around that time, in fact, that this idea started to grow?
I don't know, actually. I think it perhaps came a little later. I think that Cillian and Max, you know, the concept of it grew from conversations they were having early on in lockdown, I think. You know, I think a lot of it came from, but perhaps the seeds of it emerged around that time. I don't know, but certainly I know that the monologue that Max wrote was sort of born out of his conversations with Cillian, you know, and thinking, like we've all been thinking, you know, during this crazy year about the world and about what's important and about, you know, our human connection and all our failings, I guess. So I think it was, you know, there was a lot of it was inspired by the moment that we're going through.
To what extent then were you presented with this monologue from Max Porter, with Cillian Murphy in mind as the performer, presented with this text, which you then said this would make a great film, or did they come to you saying this would make a great film? How did that collaboration, how did the three of you become the triangle that made the film?
I think at first they maybe had talked about a stage play, and then they decided, probably, or I don't know, Cillian might have decided that he didn't have the energy to do that, perhaps, or who knows, you know, takes so much out of you physically doing something like that for a long period. But so I think then they thought, oh, maybe it would make a film. And at that point, they got a producer involved called Mary Hickson, and she was the one who came to me then. And actually, at first, I didn't realize that Cillian and Max were involved. She just asked me about making a film, and you know, in the email it mentions about John Hopkins, so it was kind of like that he would potentially be involved. And because I'd worked with him before, I thought that sounded good. And then once we got on the phone, it transpired that Max and Cillian
were involved.
And yeah, so then it kind of evolved from there. And then I think after that, the Desners got involved too. And yeah, so that's sort of how it happened.
So the visuals that you gave us, did that kind of visual world, which maybe you would describe it as it is in the film and what it was you were going for, did that visual world present itself pretty immediately to you when you read the text?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I kind of worked that way. I saw, obviously there's this, you know, what I got given was this beautiful piece of text, you know, this soliloquy, I guess, which was very honest and confessional and poetic. And from there, I built a treatment. You know, that's normally how I begin. I build out a treatment, and then from there I start to storyboard. And I just try to, in the storyboard, just build out the visual physical journey I see, or the images, and then from there I start thinking about the sounds. So yeah, it's sort of it's pretty instinctive process, really. But then, you know, it's trying to then communicate it via storyboards and treatments. So you know with your crew, and from there it was like finding locations, and yeah.
So and the location that we're in, we happen to be in London, but in fact it could be any city. Yeah. There's a kind of a nameless quality to it, and we're in the city at night. Basically, yes. Cillian Murphy's character walking, it would seem, endlessly through this city at night, and a pretty deserted city, it has to be said. You know, we did see Cillian in Danny Boyle's 28 Days Later walking through a deserted London, but this was a different type of desert. And I'm guessing, given the hour of night and given that we were probably in the midst of lockdown, it was fairly easy to get empty streets, was it?
Yeah, that was a real blessing, to be honest. Well, you know, the only blessing, I guess, of what we've all been going through. As a filmmaker, it was a blessing in the sense that I did see it being quite an isolated journey. I mean, it just seemed to fit that. Certain places, were incredibly empty. Other places we kind of had to find our windows, but overall, I mean, it was for instance, we filmed on Brick Lane, a place that you would never see empty, you know, so that was quite a strange experience for all of us, you know, seeing it so quiet.
I'll play a clip from the piece, All of This Unreal Time, and it's obviously it's Cillian Murphy because it's basically just him in the film itself, and here he is wondering about the cost of his lifestyle and the cost of false apologies.
Was I ever taught about exploitation, violence, the cost of mine and others' lifestyles, the true meaning of everything I buy and imbibe and watch sail by? And I see clearly two paths, one of which is sorry for all of this, and one of which is a tabletop of neatly wrapped stones. And on each stone is a false apology, and we can throw them at people like us and not risk any broken glass. None of this is my fault. I was never taught it, you see, and nor did I learn how to ask. You could drive yourself mad, going micro, staying local, saying sorry for every falling thing, letting the dark back in. None of this is anything to do with me. It's culture's deep. It's Dad's fault, back and back and back.
And that's Cillian Murphy in a clip there from All of This Unreal Time, short film from Aoife McArdle, who's speaking to me this evening. We get a sense of this character. He's walking through the streets, as I said, Aoife. Sometimes it's in voiceover, the thoughts are going on in his head. Sometimes he's speaking the words, not directly to the camera, as it were, but kind of speaking them almost to himself. But he is speaking them as he walks along. Did you, with Cillian, did you get involved in looking at backstories? He talks to his granny at another point along the way. He's apologising to her for certain things. He talks to other characters. Did you fill in a backstory, or did you just work with the text you had and that was it?
I mean, the beauty of the project was everyone was so, I mean, it was such a liberating experience, and that we sort of all, you know, on each stage of it, each person kind of got to bring their thing to the journey. And so, like, I got given the text, and from there, yeah, it was more about, you know, what my, in a way, like what my interpretation was, but also in a way of like trying to make a film where any viewer can bring their own interpretation to it, and allowing the film to have that space, you know, for it to exist in a different way for everyone who watches it. So that was sort of the way that we all wanted to approach the project. So I guess, yeah, I felt like there was all this beautiful memory in there, and, you know, you know, a mixture of like regret and, you know, all these kind of vulnerable feelings and things. But yeah, I guess things like the granny moments and stuff, I just tried to bring them out via the sound design, really. I mean, I kind of, you know, but those details, you know, are beautifully written in there already, in Max's words. And really what I did was just then try to bring those in different moments via the film, but sonically, and try to kind of bring out the memory in different places, and sometimes contrast it in different ways. And
I guess that's the art of the filmmaking, isn't it? To highlight those things without it being obvious how you've done it, which is what you've managed. One final question on it, Aoife, which, you know, normally on a film set, you might be talking about a couple of night shoots. I'm guessing with this film, because it happens right through the night, it must have been one long series of night shoots. And what kind of challenges did that give in terms of just light, which is what you need for film?
Mm-hmm. I was definitely all set up. We did a lot of planning, me and my crew. I have a fantastic crew in London, that, and we worked really hard to try and manage that and make sure we had the lighting we needed when we didn't have the resources in that particular location. But a lot of it was in the locations that I chose. I tried to find places that already had that light that, you know, would be right. And, you know, I've gathered a lot of images over the years just from filming there, and, you know, I was thinking of different places that I knew. And so anyway, a lot of that part came into it. But at the same time, we did, we endured pretty horrendous weather as well. We weren't expecting torrential rain to be quite as much of a feature of the film. Yeah. So really, I embraced that as well. Yeah.
And you even put poor old Killian lying down on the ground in a big puddle at one stage. And I believe there had to be a second take on that particular piece because the camera wasn't working.
Yeah, because our camera for... Per cameraman had
something
a
went
bit
wrong.
Of a nightmare. It got wet. It got completely wet. So we just on that key moment where you don't want to have to ask an actor to do something that's not very comfortable again. And I had to, but you know, he was good.
Well, that's Killian Murphy for you, isn't it? No mess in there. Listen, Aoife, great to speak with you. That's Aoife McArdle, and all of this on Real Time is available to watch online as part of the Manchester International Festival. You can find out details on MIF. Manchester International Festival, mif.co.uk. That's our lot for this evening. Liam Murphy and Paula Shields researched. Janice Murphy was the broadcast coordinator. Gareth Duffy was in sound this evening. Tonight's programme produced by Sinead Egan. Talk to you tomorrow night at 7.